88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. Please stay tuned for About Health.
Good afternoon and welcome to About Health. I'm so glad you can join us today. How is your health as a man, or the health of the men and boys you care about? On average, men die 5 years younger than women, and they're more likely to suffer from chronic diseases and to die first from all leading causes of death. And while this gender disparity is true for all men, there are even greater disparities among men. Black men, for example, die 6 years younger than white men. And this kind of disparity is consistent among men. In the United States, ethnic and sexual minority men and boys have the greatest health risks of anyone. They have the shortest lives, greatest threats to their safety and well-being, and less access to health care and social support. Contributing to these disparities are the facts that, compared to other men and boys, ethnic and sexual minority males are more likely to live in poverty, to have fewer educational opportunities, to be underemployed or unemployed, to be incarcerated, to be exposed to toxic substances, to experience crime or difficulty meeting basic needs, and to have experienced discrimination. All of these factors undermine the ability of these men and boys to maintain good mental and physical health. That's according to a new report just released by the American Psychological Association. The report is titled Health Disparities in Racial, Ethnic, and Sexual Minority Men and Boys. This report includes an extensive review of research and data to support its findings, but also recommendations for research, public policy, clinical practice, and public awareness related to the topic. The report identifies a variety of biological, social, psychological, behavioral, and structural factors that contribute to the risks of these men and boys. It also acknowledges how these factors are influenced by the social conditions in which these boys and men are born, grow, live, work, and age or develop. Today on About Health, we're going to be talking about the health of ethnic and sexual minority men and boys. And joining us by phone to discuss this are two authors of the report. Dr. Perry Halkitis is Dean and Professor of Biostatistics and Urban Global Public Health at the School of Public Health at Rutgers University. He's also founder and director of the Center for Health, Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies, which is nationally recognized for its study of LGBTQ health, HIV disparities, substance use, and mental health concerns. Dr. Halkitis, welcome to About Health.
Thank you. I'm happy to be up with you.
And we're happy to have you. Also joining us by phone is Dr. Derek Griffith. He is professor of medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Men's Health at Vanderbilt. Trained in psychology and public health, Dr. Griffith studies racial and ethnic differences in the life expectancy of men and how to use technology and behavior change to reduce men's risks of developing and dying from chronic diseases. Dr. Griffith, I'm so glad you can join us on About Health.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. And let's begin with you. It is well documented for a long time that there are significant differences in how long men of different racial or ethnic groups will live. What do you think helps explain these differences, and what might we do about them?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show, and along with Dr. Halkitis and Dr. Courtney. I think one of the biggest things is to, it's easy to kind of say that the issues are complex, but they really are important to recognize how difficult these things are to change. Some of them have to do with factors that you sort of described in the introduction, you know, about where they live, how they live, and so forth. But a lot of those require us to really, to understand them, really require us to put what about those particular groups and their identities put them at most risk. So what is it about African-American or Latino men that, you know, maybe put them at higher risk for discrimination at multiple levels? What is it about, the LGBT community that we need to pay attention to in terms of homophobia and so forth? So what is it about these kind of structural things that we need to really pay attention to? And a lot of those have to do with the kinds of things that males have to deal with, as well as how they cope with stress. And so I would say that one of the biggest things that we anchored even the report in was how do we better understand stress and issues related to stress like trauma, depression, and coping behaviors and things like substance abuse and other sources of stress like violence.
So, Dr. Griffith, are you there?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I just want to thank you. Thank you for that. And so we'll certainly want to come back to that. I think that topic of how men cope with stress, because as you and I both know, and Dr. Halkidis knows, that they don't cope with it so well, and that's one of the things that does need to be addressed. Dr. Halkidis, the focus of your work is LGBTQ health. Let's start by talking just about gay men. What are the biggest challenges and barriers these men face in trying to maintain good mental and physical health?
Yes, well, thank you for that question again. Thank you for having me on the show. So I want to dovetail what Dr. Griffin was talking about, which is the role that biological phenomena, psychological phenomena, and social phenomena play in shaping behavior. And I think for a very long time, we thought about medical issues being completely driven by pathogens and biological phenomena. And what we know very clearly at this point in time in our history in this country, that the chronic conditions, mental health issues, substance use, stress, in some ways, things like HIV and other STIs, are driven by social and structural phenomena that create these disparities. So for gay men in particular, my work has really tried to disentangle the extent to which structural inequalities, the extent to which discrimination, both, you know, on the community level, but also state-sanctioned discrimination. And what do I mean by that? I mean things like the Masterpiece cake shop case, which, you know, seems like it shouldn't have an effect on health, but in fact, gives a very clear message to gay men that somehow their marriages are less important than heterosexual people. So structural inequalities, social inequalities, discrimination, homophobia, these are the things that continue to fuel the disparities that we see in gay men. And I do want to add also, as we're having this conversation, it's important to remember that the groups we're talking about, racial and ethnic minority men and gay and bisexual men, are not, you know, separate and unrelated. In fact, when we look at gay and bisexual men who are also racial and ethnic minority men, these men have even more pronounced health disparities than their white counterparts.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, let's drill down a little bit more on that, Dr. Halkidis. And so when we talk about how these, you know, structural barriers kind of influence and shape people's behavior, can you describe some of the ways that that happens for our listeners?
Yeah, so I've actually just finished writing a book where I'm examining the coming out in life experiences of the three generations of gay men, which I'm calling the queer generation, the AIDS generation, and the Stonewall generation, ranging from age 19 to 78. And now what's really remarkably interesting to me is that despite the fact that we've had some political advances and some social changes, what is common for all gay men is this feeling of otherness that we experience, I as a gay man also, from a very young age. This feeling of otherness and this feeling of difference that we can't put our hands on. And that leads to loneliness, which is perpetuated, unfortunately, by society, which continues to other us, which in turn imparts upon us and creates within us psychological burdens. These psychological burdens, including experiences of depression, in turn may engender risk behaviors, which in turn may place the health of men at risk. So, for example, why does HIV continue to happen at such extremely high rates in the gay population, and in particular in the African-American gay population? It's not that African-American gay men are saying, I want to get HIV, but they are growing up in a society that discriminates against them because they're black, discriminates against them because they are gay, diminishes their psychological well-being, and in the context of diminished psychological well-being, one has to somehow cope with these feelings. And many people deal with them in a proactive way. Other people react in a less proactive way, engaging in sex and drug use behaviors. So this is how I understand the connections between the social phenomena and the actual behaviors, and ultimately the transmission of diseases across people.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you very much for drawing that out in that way. If you're just joining us, you're listening to About Health. I'm Dr. Will Courtney, your host. Today, we're talking with two authors of a new report just released by the American Psychological Association about health disparities among men and boys, focusing on ethnic and sexual minority men. And we're going to want to hear from you. We'll be taking your call shortly. Our number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. And we'd especially like to hear from you, men of color who are listening, as well as any men who are gay, bi, or trans. I'm sure you've heard lots of messages about taking personal responsibility for your health, which is great, but it's not so easy to do with the stresses and barriers you can face. So we'd like to hear from you about the unique challenges to your health and well-being that you face, as well as how you might have overcome them. And if you're a woman, you may have concerns or questions about the men and boys in your life, your husband or partner, your father or son, or your brother. Please call us. The number to call is 1-800-958-9008. You can also email me, Dr. Will, at kpfa.org. That's D-R-W-I-L-L at kpfa.org. And if you're a health professional, you might have witnessed some of the barriers these men face. We'd love to hear from you and get your perspective on this problem. Dr. Griffith, I'd like to turn to you again. The APA report highlights the role that trauma plays in the lives of males. Can you say a bit more about how trauma affects men's health?
Sure. I mean, I think to kind of pick up on Dr. Hauktidis's point, I mean, if you think about the sources of trauma or the way that we think about trauma, we have to kind of really look at it more than just looking at how much individuals have experienced particular types of assaults or anything like that. One of the things that the report draws out, because it pulls on the experience of Native American men, African American men, and I think you could even, we can sort of defer to Dr. Hauktidis about this, I would say men in the LGBT community, kind of this idea of historical trauma, or these broader ideas of over time, these things that have happened to a particular population that affect them over the life course. And I think his example of the generations that he's studying in his book are a perfect example of how the history of trauma that those particular men have experienced is a really important way to understand how their health has kind of been compromised over time. Within the same body, you know, if you experience something at 18 and it affects you in a particular way, as you kind of continue to grow, those things that you may experience that as stressful, as difficult to cope with, continue to snowball and continue to grow, even, and they can have an effect on you even after you've kind of dealt with them. So I think those kinds of traumas, you know, in addition to, we do definitely sort of underreport and underappreciate, you know, how much men are victims of interpersonal violence, sexual assault, combat-related trauma, and so forth are definitely things that disproportionately affect males. But it's important to kind of look at these kinds of traumas and so forth in a broader context and look at them at multiple levels, not just in the very narrow way that typically we've sort of looked at them in terms of, you know, childhood sexual abuse, sexual assault, hate crimes, and those kinds of things. Not to say that those aren't hugely important, but they are. But the experiences of trauma are much broader than that.
And cumulative.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, and stress is, of course, a big factor that influences men's health. But we don't talk a lot about stress, but you two do. But let's talk about the influence of stress on not just on mental health, but on health behaviors and shaping health behaviors. Dr. Hauktidis?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that in our society, we have very rigid definitions, unfortunately, of what it means to be a man, right? And, you know, something that I've explored in my own work are the role that hypermasculinity plays in perpetuating health disparities in the populations that we're talking about. I think for men, a great source of stress is this need to conform to what society deems a man actually is and a man actually does. And so when someone is feeling stressed, the emotions are too much to handle, and they have to be managed somehow. On occasion, men and women and people of all along the gender continuum who experience stress turn to drugs, turn to sex as a way of ameliorating those feelings. And so when I think about what happens in the gay male population, the hypermasculinization that is sort of adopted by the community because society tells you you can't be a man if you have sex with other men, creates enormous feelings of diminished feelings of self-worth that one can either effectively cope with or copes with through the use of sex and drugs. And if you're using sex, and drugs as a means of coping, one, obviously, we all know the effect that drugs have on the body. But two, we know that sex becomes a vector for the transmission of pathogens like HIV that continue to this day to bombard the LGBTQ, the gay population in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned masculinity, and as we all, the three of us all know, there's actually decades of research studying, looking at masculinity and the influence on masculinity on a wide range of behaviors and in terms of coping and how effectively men do cope with the stress that they experience. And men who tend to hold more traditional ideas about how a man should be, more kind of constricted notions of what a man should be, are much greater risk for responding kind of poorly and unhealthy ways to the stress that they experience and making matters even worse. They're less likely to seek help for it. The report takes a multidisciplinary approach to addressing this problem. And this is something I've advocated related to men's health for decades myself. And it draws, both from public health and psychological perspectives, for example. Dr. Griffith, maybe you can talk about why you think it's important that we take this multidisciplinary approach to this problem.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think, again, sort of dovetailing on what both of you said thus far, to understand stress, we have to understand the sources of stress. And the sources of stress aren't always necessarily that obvious, nor are they necessarily negative. So, if you're a male and you're trying to be successful in school and successful in your work, trying to contribute financially to your household and to your home, that can be a very important source of stress. And those are very highly, we put a lot of value on men fulfilling those particular roles. And, their efforts to fulfill those roles can be exactly the kinds of things that they will say are, in our work, have said, are the things that impede their ability to, or the ability, or their desire to prioritize things that would be healthier ways of dealing with stress, like being, regularly exercising, getting adequate amounts of sleep, and those kinds of things. That those are protective behaviors that also help to manage stress. So it's really understanding, that those sources of stress run very deep into our culture and in our society. They can be very distinct depending on, how men identify, both in terms of, race and ethnicity, in terms of even, if you primarily identify, say, with potentially a military background, that may be kind of your most prominent sort of identity, and how those things shaped, in the military, how are you expected to cope with stress? You're expected to kind of, I hate the term man up, but, sort of deal with it and just cope with it and just face it and face it head on, as opposed to potentially a strategy that would suggest being something of a bit more strategic about how you would deal with it, or decide, maybe this isn't really necessary for me to deal with directly at all. Maybe I need to find some other way or some supports to basically figure out whether or not this is important for me to deal with. Mm-hmm. So I think it really is a much, again, sort of not to try to make everything really complicated, but I think recognizing that, economic factors, how people see themselves, how their communities and networks that they identify with see and value them, that all of those things can be important sources of stress that we haven't really always appreciated, particularly in the context of men and boys' health.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if I could, Dr. Courtney, I'm wondering if I could add something to my...
Of course. Yeah, please do.
About the multidisciplinarity. I think, you know, all you need to, I think, just to bring it home for your listeners also, like, how many of us have heard the expression, be a man, right, in our lives, right? You know, expressions that, you know, I take offense to, because it means that somehow I and others who are male, who identify as male, have to bottle up our emotions. Right? So there is the cultural aspect of what it means to be a man. We have to recognize also there, as Dr. Griffith, economic factors. When you look at, for example, women in what had been traditionally male professions, these women navigate those spaces. But men do not navigate the spaces that are traditionally female professions. What does that tell you? It tells you about very rigid norms in our society. And so therefore, getting to your question, why not just a psychological perspective or a medical perspective? Because in fact, what it means to be a man and how a man's health is shaped is a biological, a cultural, an economic, you know, a spiritual, you know, a psychological phenomenon. And you must have a multidisciplinary approach to understand how to improve it.
Yes. Well said. And I'd like to just dovetail what Dr. Griffith was saying with, I think it dovetails nicely with the notion of resilience, which is another topic that's, you know, addressed throughout the report. Dr. Griffith, you want to speak to that, the notion of resilience and how that plays into all of this?
Sure. I'm happy to start. I mean, I think resilience is one of those terms that we, and just the positive aspect of how do you build on the positives of a community? I mean, everything, you know, when we tend to characterize the populations that were the focus of this report, we tend to only look at the negatives of those communities and populations. But there's, and even just the idea of framing them both in terms of minority and minority status kind of misses the strength of both sets of communities that we're sort of characterizing in this report. Yet, if we think about it, the communities have dealt with a lot and somehow or another managed to be successful, managed to function, albeit not as ideally as they would like, but, you know, certainly in ways that we would not expect given the amount of stressors, the amount of kind of barriers, the institutional barriers and the repeated barriers across the life course that they experience. One of my mentors and colleagues used to, James Jackson, who's a professor at University of Michigan, would always say, you know, it's amazing that certain populations aren't crazier than they are, in the sense mm-hmm. that, you know, given what they've experienced,
yes.
how is it that you're not just kind of balled up in a fetal position in the corner
mm-hmm.
because of all the stuff that you're constantly sort of facing and the discouragement that can come with at every turn? There can be things that hit you that you feel like are very unfair and that you don't really have the same faith that you're going to be treated fairly. So the fact that people are able to overcome that both as individuals and somehow or another muster that kind of thing up has to be put in the context of who's helping to sort of build that in them, or instill that in them, continue to nurture that in them. It's going to be, you know, peers of whoever their networks and peers are, whoever their loved ones are, their communities, and kind of the strengths that they've built on from watching people who they admire and look up to and that look like them or they see themselves as. So it's really putting that in that larger context that we really have to do to understand resilience.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Griffith, for that. And let's go to some of our callers now. And we want to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. We want you to join the conversation. Love to hear from men. And, you know, if you're a woman and have concerns about the men and boys in your life, we'd like to hear from you as well. Or if you're a health professional that's seen some of the challenges these men face, please give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. Let's go to our first caller right now, and that is Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to About Health.
Thank you. Well, I happen to be disabled. I'm 75 years old, and I'm glad to hear the emphasis placed on the issue of stress. This is something that I think myself and probably countless other Americans are going to healthcare professionals to try and treat. And unfortunately, if there isn't a pharmaceutical available or some other readily or handy tool that a doctor may have, you're pretty much left on your own to develop or to cope and to build resiliency. And I'm not sure, you know, how one does that on their own. That's a big part of the problem. I think people who are marginalized in society, whether it's, you know, for whatever reason, they're marginalized, they're poor, they're disabled, they're gay, they're people of color, et cetera, you know, dealing with overwhelming levels of stress. And my experience has been too often that you're left to go off on your own and manage that stress. And I happen to think that, unfortunately, the systems that we live with, the institutions, are stressful in themselves. We live in an economic system, capitalism, that is incredibly stressful to a lot of people. By the way, the health outcomes that people will see in this country, despite all the money that's spent on health care, are not very good, and you've got to wonder why. I was just thinking when you were on the air, and I'll finish with this. I wonder if the American Psychiatric or Psychological Association would come out and just say, you know what, this is an unhealthy country to live in, and here are the reasons why. We've got huge levels of poverty, we've got discrimination, we've got all of this. That's what's causing people, or a great deal of what's causing people to get sick. So what do we do about it? Well, we don't just rely on people to cope. We got to change that system. So anyway, for what it's worth, I thank you for the program, and I appreciate the emphasis. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Greg. We appreciate your call. And Dr. Griffith or Dr. Halkidis, you want to respond to Greg?
I mean, I think this is Dr. Halkidis. I think, you know, what Greg speaks to very eloquently, and, you know, he also, first of all, brings another identity to the table here as we're thinking about the health of boys and men.
Yes.
Instead of a disabled person, right? So here's another piece of who a person is. I think there is an over biomedicalization of stress and all health issues in our country, and Greg is completely right. And what we find ourselves is within our healthcare system, which is, let's face it, broken, right? Doctors do not have the time or the space to care for these other aspects of their patients' well-being. And I'll give you an example of what I did in my teaching, which I think was illuminating to my students. For like 15 years, I would take students every January to London to study HIV. And people would ask me, well, why do you take them there? And the answer was very simple. Because under the National Health Service, an HIV-positive person goes to a clinic, and there's a social worker there, and a psychologist, and an advocate, and somebody to help with finances. Because they understand that there is a whole person at play here. Our system doesn't understand that. And I think what we have to do as people who are working in the social sciences, as psychologists, as social workers, and as psychiatrists, is demand the integration of those types of care with the biomedical aspects of care that we deliver.
Yes. Dr. Griffith, Derek Griffith, would you like to add anything to that or respond to
sure,
Greg's comments?
Yeah, I think both Greg and Dr. Altidis, you know, both said it very eloquently. I think the thing I would add is, you know, when you talked about how to develop resilience on your own, I completely agree with him. That's the misnomer, is that we should expect that people are going to develop it on their own. I think that's something that, you know, men tend to think that, okay, if I have this problem, then I need to solve the problem on my own, versus looking to social supports and other models or people that they may look to figure out, well, how did so-and-so do it? So is there something I can learn from other people, or can I get in a group or connected to somebody, whether it's virtually or in person, to really learn how do you do it? Because a lot of times we tend to think of things that we're the only one who's experiencing it. We tend to sort of treat issues as though it's somehow or another unique to us as a male. And most of the time, that's not necessarily true. I think the other part that sort of at the higher level that both Greg and Dr. Altidis mentioned, that I'll add a little bit to, is, you know, one of the biggest challenges we have in our society, and it has been documented consistently, that relative to other high-income countries, our health and life expectancy is at the bottom. And while others are continuing to improve and increase, we're kind of flattening out in terms of the life expectancy. And a lot of that, some are attributing to the income inequality or the inequalities in our society, the distance between the haves and the have-nots, and the concentration of wealth in a few, and the resources that are lacking in the many. And that income, that gap that is between the best of the best in terms of resources and those who have the least, is one of the things that puts a strain on the society as a whole. It's not when you when you step back and zoom back and look at it as a whole, we have to kind of realize that that's stressful to a large swath of our population and on the resources that we have that aren't really designed to deal with those kinds of inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one other thing that I think we should I picked up too, as you did on Greg's comment about people trying to cope on their own, and of course we know men are more likely or more inclined to do that, but I think it's also important. I'm a big advocate of challenging some of the social norms. Actually, in my own research, this is a good example. You ask men if they are concerned about their health, and they'll say, yes, I am concerned about my health, and they'll list what they're concerned about. And you ask, do you think other men are concerned about their health? And they'll say, no. And so, which of course is, statistically is impossible. So the fact is these men think that other men aren't concerned about, most men are concerned about their health, but they think most other men are not concerned about their health. And I think we need to shift that perspective. And it's always such a fine line we walk as we talk about these topics. Because men also do seek help. And in fact, they're increasingly doing so. We've seen over the last 10 years, increasingly, they're using mental health services. And so it's important to recognize that men do get help. Many men do. And, it's sort of normal. That's the social norm that we need to change here, is that it's normal to seek help. We all need help in coping, with stress. And also we seek help differently in different ways. So, African American men are probably oftentimes more likely to go to a pastor to seek help rather than go to a psychotherapist. So we need to take that into account as well. So anyway, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to About Health. I'm Dr. Will Courtney, your host. We're talking today about a new report just released by the American Psychological Association titled Health Disparities in Racial, Ethnic, and Sexual Minority Men and Boys. Our guests are two of the authors of the report, both joining us by phone. Dr. Perry Halkidis is Dean of the School of Public Health at Rutgers University, and Dr. Derek Griffith is a professor of medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University. Both of these fellows are also the founders and directors of two centers. Dr. Halkidis directs the Center for Health, Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies, focusing on LGBTQ health. And Dr. Griffith directs the Center for Research on Men's Health at Vanderbilt University. We would like you to join the conversation. What are the barriers to health and well-being of men in color or LGBTQ men that you've seen? That may be your own experience, or maybe someone you know or care about. And as one of these men, what's helped you to attend to your health despite obstacles you might have faced? We want to hear what worked for you. And perhaps you're a healthcare provider and notice firsthand the barriers that these men face. We'd love to hear from you as well. Please give us a call at 1-800-958-9008. 958-9008. You can also email me at drwill@kpfa.org. kpfa.org. And it looks like we lost our last caller, Jennifer. Jennifer, if you're listening, and you want to call back, we hadn't forgotten about you. Dr. Halkidis, would you please identify for our listeners some of the health risks faced, sort of the broad kind of range of health risks faced by sexual minority men?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for asking that question. I think for 35 or more years, we've defined, sexual minority men's health as HIV health. And, prior to 1996, before the development of effective medications, maybe that was appropriate. But at this point in time, it is, unfortunately, continues to dominate the way we think about the health of LGBT, you know, gay and bisexual boys and men. And I encourage anyone who's listening to take a look at the 2011 report that was published by the National Academy that spoke about the health disparities of the LGBTQ population at large. But HIV is only one of the many problems faced by gay men. Gay men experience heightened levels of substance use. They experience heightened levels of psychopathology, including depression. They experience the reality of intimate partner violence, which is very much studied in opposite sex couples, but only beginning to be studied in same sex couples. Gay men experience high rates of HPV infection. Now, what is so problematic and troubling to me, I just finished doing an analysis of some data from one of our studies and a sample of young men who came of age after 2006 when vaccination for HPV was available, and some 75% had never been vaccinated. These young men are at high risk now for oral cancer and anal cancer, and we know that in the gay male population, the intersection of HIV and HPV has led to this exponential burst in anal cancer in the population. Other factors that are at play are cigarette smoking, which, you know, is targeted. The tobacco industry targets the population, and violence. You know, I think we tend to forget that not only the role of intimate partner violence, but the experience of violence in the lives of, you know, racial and ethnic minority men and, you know, and gay and bisexual men. If you are a man of color, if you are a gay man, you are more likely to be somehow harassed and potentially physically assaulted than if you are a white man. So I think these are the major issues that compromise and create stress in the lives of gay and bisexual men.
Dr. Griffith, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, just picking up particularly on the last point, I think we have to also realize that just the exposure to the media, I mean, the fact that we see all of these reports on a constant basis of particularly men of color and particularly black men, you know, with police-involved shootings and just other kinds of things that being harassed and so forth in different ways, that you have these kinds of things that we're seeing in our society. And simply by just identifying yourself with that particular person who's being harassed or that has been the victim of something like this is in and of itself a source of stress and trauma. And the idea that you're going to constantly have to be concerned about yourself or loved ones who may fit those particular profiles is a really important source of stress that we tend to underestimate.
And then, of course, they're getting the message, you not only have to deal with that, but then, you know, be sure to watch your diet and to get out and exercise, and which, of course, becomes more challenging when you're faced with those kinds of stressors.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about some of the recommendations in the report. And before I do, I want to just give out the number again and encourage our callers to call in. That number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008, or you can email me at drwill@kpfa.org. I'd really love to hear from you again, not just men, but also women in the lives of these men, and also healthcare providers. We'd really like to hear from you about your perspective on some of the challenges you've seen men of color or sexual minority men face as they come through your doors. Give us a call again at 1-800-958-9008. So let's go to some of the recommendations, and these range from research and public policy to clinical practice and then public awareness. Dr. Halkidis, what do you think are the leading edge here in terms of what needs to happen?
Well, I think that good science always has to lead the way. I think that, you know, we find ourselves in this really troubling time where decisions are being made not based on scientific principles, but based on people's whims very often. So I think that it is incumbent upon all of us who are doing science to continue to demand that science be funded and that good science be enacted. That's it. Oh, it's number one. That would be number one. I think we were also very, very, very careful in the report to make sure there was research, clinical practice, and policy, because none of us believe that one of those areas in and of itself could solve the problems we're facing here. So what we're talking about is that researchers work with policymakers and work with the doctors and the clinicians you're asking to call, you know, during this hour to enhance the well-being of boys and men. So taking the science, knowing what the obstacles are, changing the policies which undermine the well-being of boys and men, and then translating that to clinical practice, both in the medical and the psychological profession, to deliver services that are appropriate for boys and men. These are the most important things we can do.
Mm-hmm. And what does clinical practice, how does all of this knowledge then shape clinical practice?
Well, I think what it does, and I think what this report does, is it raises an awareness of the stressors in the lives of boys and men. And, you know, and we don't have to just say boys and men of color and LGBT, you know, LGBT boys and men. We just say all boys and men. I think what it does, it says that we might need different approaches for working with boys and men than we do with women. And so one size doesn't fit all here. We need to tailor things that are appropriate. We need to understand the roles of masculinity and hypermasculinity and the toxicity it plays. And we have to, in our clinical practice, attend to those social conditions which undermine the mental health of our patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'm going to give the number out again. I'm going to make a call out to shout out to moms there, who have boys and are raising boys. Give us a call. We have two, great guests here on the show who would love to respond to any questions that you have about your sons, or your brothers or husbands. And the number is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. Dr. Derek Griffith, do you want to, also just address what your thoughts about just the practice policy implications of this report?
Sure. I think the first fundamental thing is just that one size doesn't fit all, and that we have to pay attention to one of the things that the report sort of highlights is the, you know, in terms of public policy, we need to pay attention to do the policies that we enact, whether intentionally or not, affect populations differently. And we need to look at, you know, our you know, men in general or men and boys in general or specific groups of males affected differently by the policies that we enact, regardless of what their intention was, and that we need to then pay more attention explicitly to those. Some of those policies, like the policies around juvenile justice and incarceration that we mentioned in here, you know, are a bit removed in some ways from health. And so we don't tend to think of that from a health or public health sort of standpoint, yet we know that those kinds of stressors, both on individuals and on a community, can be huge impacts on how they think about life chances, just what kinds of things happen when men are returned into the community, what kinds of opportunities they have, and so forth. So I think all of those play a huge part in how we better understand these kinds of recommendations. I think from a clinical standpoint, I think it highlights that these are questions or the issues that we raise in the report, I think, as Dr. Hauptita said, are then questions that we might want to probe or have clinicians or medical professionals probe males when they see them in their offices. So mm-hmm. Ask about stress, ask about trauma, you know, do more screeners for depression and anxiety and those kinds of things. Look for, you know, potentially more gendered sort of expressions of stress. So maybe look for substance use as a way to that males are dealing with stress. Maybe pay attention to maybe it's not going to be an expression of sadness. Maybe you're going to ask about irritability and anger outbursts and those kinds of things that men are more likely to admit to and share as a way to express their anger and frustration, and that we see as more in our society, more okay for males to utilize as ways to express their negative emotions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really just paying attention to these are things that, you know, in any time that health professionals very broadly defined would come in contact with males, these are the kinds of things you'd want to ask.
Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of things, you know, men listening might want to be thinking about talking with their healthcare providers about if they don't ask about that. You know, this, oftentimes health in terms of depression, for example, you know, healthcare providers may not see what we call, you know, externalizing behaviors. So, you know, working too much as a symptom of, depression, or drinking too much. These are some of the ways that men are more likely than women to cope with depression. And as you were pointing out, Dr. Griffith, the health professionals oftentimes don't look for those other signs, when they're, evaluating men for depression. So now the report notes that these health disparities create a burden not only for the boys and men themselves, but also for the families, communities, and our nation as a whole, is what the report says. Can you talk about that, Dr. Halkidis?
Yeah, I think that I want to also, before I jump into that, I also want to maybe circle around to something that I think we also should keep on our agenda and think about, which is the role of body image and body dysmorphia and disordered eating, which, you know, goes completely understudied and unnoticed in boys and men and is clearly an issue. But, you know,
and that's for those listeners who picked up on that, we just did a show recently with a Harvard professor on that very topic. And you can look back through the archives if you'd like to listen to that show. It was a really great show, and he was a great guest. Continue.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and thank you for doing that. I mean, I think if you don't look like a character out of the movie 300, something's wrong with your body.
Right.
That's the society we live in. So,
right. I'm in trouble.
Yeah, we're all in trouble. Right. The fact is that boys and men, you know, that no man is an island. No boy is an island. No person is an island. People exist within social circles, whether it's their families, whether it's their communities, whether it's their religious institutions, whether it's their nations, right? And so the push and pull exists both within the context of the person, but always also within the context of the social structure. So I'll give you an example, you know, and I'm going to talk about gay men. We think about the coming out process, you know, as this, you know, enormous event in the lives of young gay men. And in fact, what I always challenge my heterosexual friends, my straight friends with is, imagine if for the rest of your life, you had to come out as being straight, right? Because those of us who are gay, that happens all the time. Our whole lives were coming out. Yes, there may be one monumental event, but for the rest of our lives, we're clarifying for people that we're gay. So imagine the stress that creates. But think about the family, right? Think about how people relate to each other, the mother, the father, the caregivers, and the child. They've established these relations, right? And now the child, you know, reveals his identity to the parents. Not only is it a period of adjustment for the child in relation to the parents, but it is a period of adjustment for the parents in relation to the child. So that dynamic and that interpersonal relational, those interpersonal relational factors are what we're talking about when we talk about these health issues affecting the macro system beyond the person.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so interesting, Perry, as you were talking about having to constantly come out and re-clarify, and, you know, that's also what, so those gay men are having to do that as men as well, because, we know, kind of the way that people who study masculinity, we talk about this, that men are having to constantly prove manhood on a daily basis.
Yep.
So those men are that stress is then compounded, not only having to come out gay, but also to come out as a man. And that is something that is a stress that all men, and especially, again, men of color who have other stressors that they're having to deal with, have to cope with.
I think, you're exactly right. And I think that the gay community has in some ways a huge responsibility here in perpetuating this toxic masculinity. You know, so you go to any like gay community and you see this overemphasis on this big masculine, hyper-masculine bodies, right? And that is, I don't know, I believe in somehow informed by the AIDS epidemic, right? But also in response to those stressors of what it means to be a man. both outside the gay community, but also within the gay community, and the diminishing of and bottom shame, the shaming of the passive partner that exists in, even in the gay community itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, and Dr. Griffith, I'd like you to just comment too on this. You know, the point that the report makes about, you know, it's this burden is experienced by the families, communities, and our nation as a whole. Do you want to speak to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with these issues, you know, maybe some people are not going to be swayed by the social or moral or even health angle that these things are particularly problematic for our society. But one of the things that a colleague of ours and a co-author of the report, Dr. Roland Thorpe, who's at Johns Hopkins University, he did a report about 5 years ago now that looked at the estimated costs, the medical care expenditures, both the direct medical care expenditures and the indirect sort of costs, and found that in the cost to the economy, and that African-American men, if we were to sort of have their health equivalent to the best among men in the United States, that we would be saving about $317 or $318 billion, with a B, for African-American men, and $115 billion in terms of just indirect costs for Hispanic men. If we looked at direct costs, we're talking about $448 billion that these stressors, these health issues that are the source, that are the consequence of all these things that we've been talking about, that not dealing with these things are a huge drain on our economy. So even if you don't care about the populations, even if you don't care about the health, you may care about our economy and how these things are hurting our overall economic profile of our nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the I'm so glad you were able to articulate those figures for us, Derek. I guess we haven't really talked much about violence. We know, you know, men are most oftentimes both the perpetrators and the victims of violence. Not all men are perpetrators, of course, but most of the violence that's experienced by people is experienced at the hands of other men, and most of those other people experiencing that violence are men. I'm going to hold off for that for a moment, but we have a caller, Nancy, who's calling us from Oakland. Nancy, welcome to About Health.
Hi. I just really appreciate this topic, and I realized I was feeling this real sort of like I was having to stuff a lot, and I thought, oh, well, I think it's because I'm feeling the frustration that men are having to deal with, and particularly gay men, like that we live in this patriarchy, and that they're in this situation where they're having to uphold all of that while feeling some other kinds of feelings altogether. And also I was thinking about the stress, that what relieves stress, or what are outlets for stress. And I recently heard that both curiosity and humor are two of the best ways of coping with stress. But it got me to thinking about, I wonder if there have been studies or can be studies of comparative studies among men, both men of color and also just in general gay men, where creativity, you know, like art and dance music, poetry, just all the different outlets that people can express to let go of the stress, to give it an outlet, but also to redefine. Because, I mean, I think that we actually all are going to need, if we're going to stay here on this planet, and other creatures as well, that we're going to have to redefine this notion of what patriarchy, how it's doing, and what it's doing to everybody.
Yes. Well, so that was so well said, Nancy. I really appreciate the heart and those comments and sort of bringing those feelings that you were holding sort of to the fore here for us. So I appreciate that. And yes, and we might add rap to that too is an expression that it can be a useful one. Do either of you gentlemen want to respond to Nancy's comments?
I can certainly start. I mean,
And Dr. Griffith, we've only have a moment left here, so just to give you a heads up about that.
Okay, thank you. I'll be brief. Well, I think the first thing is that, you know, men's bodies don't know, or bodies in general don't care necessarily how you deal with stress. They just want it to reduce. So there can be, you know, as Nancy's saying, positive ways of doing that, and there can be ways that, you know, can be harmful to your body over time if you utilize those strategies, you know, and over your life or in ways of doing it. So I think I don't know of studies that have necessarily looked at creativity and those types of things as ways to deal with stress, but I definitely agree with her that all of these ways of creative expression could be great ways to help men better understand how to cope with stress and find more positive ways of dealing with it that would not be harmful to their health and bodies.
Well, thank you. And you know, we are going to leave you with the last word. And I'm afraid this time has gone quickly. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Halkidis or the Center for Health, Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies, you can visit their website at wp.nyu.edu/CHIPBS. You can always go back and listen to the podcast to get that if you need to. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Griffith's work and the Center for Research on Men's Health at Vanderbilt University, you can go to www.vanderbilt.edu/CRMH for Center for Research on Men's Health. Dr. Halkidis and Dr. Griffith, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. It was a real pleasure talking with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, it was a pleasure. I also want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us, and especially Greg and Nancy for phoning in. I appreciated that. Thanks also to our board operator, Lucretia Burton. If you missed any of today's program and want to hear it, or you'd like to listen to past shows, you can find all of our podcasts at kpfa.org on the About Health page. And if you have any suggestions for future shows or guests you'd like to hear about on About Health, please email me at drwill@kpfa.org. If you'd like to learn more about me or my psychotherapy services, you can reach me at my website, themensdoc.com. That's themensdoc.com. I'd love to hear from you. From all of us at About Health, we wish you good health.
Dennis Bernstein from the Flashpoints team. Are you singing the blues about corporate news? Are you interested in the news behind the censored news? Then your ticket to the truth is Flashpoints, the electronic canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. Tune into Flashpoints every weekday at 5 p.m. on KPFA listener-sponsored radio for the Bay Area and beyond. Thank you.
Rumi's Caravan returns to Oakland. You are invited to celebrate world poetic traditions with Rumi's Caravan on July 14th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 685 14th Street in Oakland. For 17 years, Rumi's Caravan has inspired audiences, weaving together poems by Rumi, Hafez, Majalo, Rilke, Yeats, Mary Oliver, and many others in an improvised, recited, poetic conversation with musical accompaniment. Moving through moods of prayer and grief to humor and celebration, the caravan highlights the beauty of the spoken word. This performance is a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance and is wheelchair accessible. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com. For more information, call 650-327-5493.
It is now 3 o'clock here at KPFA 94.1 FM.